The new book, Shirley Chisholm in Her Own Words, Speeches and Writings, edited by Zynga A. Fraser, gives readers a rare opportunity to engage with the Congresswoman's powerful ideas in her own voice. Many Americans are familiar with Chisholm's importance as the first Black woman in Congress and the first woman and African American to run for president with either major party. This collection of her work establishes Chisholm as an unparalleled public intellectual and Black feminist both in her time and now. Learn more about Shirley Chisholm in Her Own Words, edited by Zynga A. Fraser, at ucpress.edu.
Welcome to See How They Run, horse race coverage from the left, brought to you by The Nation. I'm D.D. Guttenplan, editor of The Nation. That sound you heard at around 10:45 Eastern Time on Tuesday night was a collective sigh of relief from Democrats across the country. Kamala Harris had debated Donald Trump, and unlike Joe Biden, she had survived. Not just that, she was widely declared the winner, having successfully provoked Trump into a series of incoherent rants for most of the debate's 90 minutes. The experts love telling us that debates don't matter that much, that they rarely shift the dynamics of a campaign. We know that the Biden-Trump debate was a hellish exception to that supposed rule. But what about the Harris-Trump debate? Did Kamala Harris turn this into a different kind of race? Will Trump's meltdowns hurt his chances? Or are giddy Democrats tempting fate 2016 style? Today on See How They Run, we're debating the debate. And standing at the lectern opposite me is our national affairs correspondent, Jeet here. Jeet, it's great to have you back on See How They Run. And what a difference a month makes.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think one of the most amazing things about the this debate is the contrast between the second, between this debate and the first debate between Trump and Joe Biden. And I don't know if even the metaphor of night and day quite captures the difference. It's the difference between the dark side of the moon and the sun. and in some ways, a very one-for-one differences. Like Donald Trump gave the same answer on abortion that he did in the first debate, where he said, like, you know, like everybody wanted to get rid of Roe v. Wade,
right?
And it's now left up to the states, and that's good. And listeners will remember, this is like a total layup for anyone responding, because it's very easy to say, like, no, most Americans actually like Roe v. Wade, and leaving it to the states has caused a lot of disasters. But listeners will remember, Joe Biden didn't quite say that. He somehow used that lead up to start talking about illegal immigration and immigrants that kill people. And that was not good. Whereas Kamala Harris, not only did she answer it properly, like she answered it in like a really compelling, forceful way. Obviously, like the fact that she's a woman is a, you know, helped. But beyond that, I mean, like just like what she said on the substance was so powerful. And there's never been an American presidential candidate that has made the case for reproductive freedom as forcefully as she has, at a time where, you know, post Dobbs, it's a crucial issue for tens of millions of Americans. So, I think the easy summary is what Joe Biden was in the first debate, Donald Trump was in the second debate,
which is a tired, rambling, mm-hmm. old, not entirely credible candidate.
Exactly. And I think some listeners might recall, like, after the first debate, I had actually said, like, you know, Trump was actually terrible. It's just, unfortunately, Joe Biden was much worse. And in some ways, Biden acted as a protective cover. He was like a shield that, like, kept people from seeing how bad Trump was.
Well, you know,
in that first debate,
it's hard to pay attention to the car crash down the street when a plane has just crashed on your lawn.
That's right. So this time there was no plane crash, and so people could actually see that Trump was a car crash. But even beyond that, I mean, like, actually in the first debate, Trump was a little bit more credible just because he restrained himself. And I think he did that just because he could actually see, like, why should I do anything? Like, this the fellow I'm running against is destroying himself. Whereas this time, I think this is where Harris really deserves credit. She had a strategy, And the strategy was to bait Trump, to put out like the stuff that enrages Trump that he loves to talk about, that is actually very unpopular with swing voters. And she did that by like, you know, just like casually mentioning, well, his crowd sizes aren't so great. And I think a normal candidate with a normal brain would have just let that lie there. But Trump took the bait and started talking about, no, his crowd sizes are great. Like everyone, the most amazing crowd sizes. And at length, which is like, actually, like, you know, we know this, like voters, especially swing voters, don't want to hear that. They don't want a president that's like so concerned with, you know, the size of his crowds.
I think you were being a little unfair to Kamala Harris, because she did more than just casually mention his crowd sizes. She also said people were leaving his rallies because they were bored. I watched that clip again this morning, and his eyes popped open. I mean, it was almost as if she'd landed a physical punch. He was doing that thing that he does where he kind of draws into himself and his eyes are hooded, and, you know, and he's like, oh, I have to endure this, you know, baloney. And when, as soon as it's over, I'll be able to return to the path of truth and light. But then she popped him out of it when she said people are leaving because they're bored. And not only did he take the bait on crowd sizes, but then it was like an unforced error allowing two runs to score, because he then segued to, you know, the racist myth of immigrants eating dogs.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. No, I absolutely. Which actually, I do think Trump had planned to say anyways, but the fact that he like said it in that context, perhaps shows how provoked he was. Like it kind of, absolutely. We have to give Harris full credit here. Like, there was a strategy and she executed it to perfection of just hitting the hot buttons, and getting Trump like to become angrier and angrier, more and more flustered, and more off topic. Like in these debates, they're not really debates. They're like, your basic thing that most candidates do is just have a set of talking points that they repeat no matter what the question is. And that's what Trump did in the first debate. And this time he was constantly going off topic and digressing because Harris had like mentioned something that she knew would provoke him. So just as a strategy, I mean, like I don't think it's just not just a matter that she was like an effective speaker on her own part, but she actually like had a plan.
Had a plan, and also in the first debate, it was clear that Trump was making a big effort to stick to his talking points. And also that Biden was doing a lot of work for him. You know, when Biden said, we finally beat Medicare, you know, and then there was that other part where they were talking about their golf scores. And, you know, and then Trump said, let's be grownups here. People don't want to hear about our golf scores. I mean, so that's all true. And I totally agree with you that the Harris campaign clearly had a strategy. Not only did she execute a strategy in the debate, but her strategy was one that you'd seen before in a different kind of arena.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think to look at what Harris did, it was basically the classic rope-a-dope strategy, which is used in boxing, most famously in 1974 when it was Muhammad Ali versus George Foreman. And, you know, like Foreman had a punch, was a hitter, and Muhammad Ali like basically allowed him to get in like a lot of punches early on, also knowing that Foreman didn't have stamina, that he could not like last it out, that he would get tired, eventually, and that Ali would be able to finish him off, which worked. So you have to give the dope enough to hang himself, and that's what Harris did. I mean, if you actually look at it, like I believe Trump spoke for much more than Harris did, about 15% more. But that's partially because she was allowing him to speak, because she was like constantly like provoking him to go on talking about Charlottesville or talking about his crowd sizes, you could actually see him becoming visibly tired and flustered as the evening progressed. So I think Trump joins the rank of George Foreman as one of the great victims of the rope-a-dope strategy.
So you mentioned the fact that he spoke quite a bit longer than Harris. And, you know, some of us thought that ABC were going to be strict about turning off the mics when it wasn't your turn to speak. But that didn't happen. And I have a theory about that, which is that it was the Harris campaign that said, leave the mics open. The Trump campaign that said, turn the mics off. And yet it was Trump who kept on talking when his mic should have been off. So my theory is that Trump was assuming that they would turn his mic off, which would give him a look how the media are conspiring to silence me argument. And for that reason, ABC decided to leave him on. But what do you think?
Yeah, I think that actually makes a lot of sense. I mean, I think ABC took like risks in like other ways that were actually quite commendable as well, like in terms of actually fact checking, which CNN notably didn't do in the first debate. But I actually think, it's the sort of best policy possible, because, you know, Trump has never actually been that popular. And to some degree, the more he speaks, the less popular he becomes with the broader public. He's never won anywhere close to like a majority of the vote or even more votes than any other candidate on a national stage. I actually think, like, you know, this is something maybe liberals have to wrestle with, because they have tried to deplatform Trump, to get the people not to air his rallies or have him on Twitter. But, there's a lot of wisdom to, like, you know, letting Trump speak, because most people do not like what they hear coming out of his mouth.
Yes, Trump is not one of those about whom you would say to know him is to love him.
Yeah.
But my question is not so much could she execute that effectively, which we saw she did, but how much additional provocation was it that this bait was being laid by a Black Asian woman?
Yeah, no, I think that's a kind of a very big part of it. I think that, as compared to when he's on debate stage with Joe Biden or in the sort of primaries, against the Ron DeSantis or a Ted Cruz, there is something about Harris that, you know, like, given who Trump is, you know, given how racist and sexist he is, like there's something uncomfortable in making... And also younger, like a quite younger and very vibrant like woman, like it kind of discombobulates Trump a little bit, and he can't even use his like normal kind of like demeaning of women rhetoric, or he there was something off about him. Like he clearly was like sort of like uncomfortable and not focused and really not. And on edge, which I think very interesting, and I think like it will in terms of the impact of the debate, I think it should bring, you know, the question of like Trump's age visibly to the forefront. I it is really the case that even if you like Trump, he's not the candidate that he was like 8 years ago. Time has its effect on us all.
Yeah, no, one of the things that I kept on thinking about while watching on Tuesday night was I was in St. Louis when he debated Hillary Clinton. And that was the debate where it was right after Access Hollywood came out and, you know, the mainstream media had written him off. Basically, this was a campaign ending event. And what his response was to pack the first row of seats in the audience at Washington University with women who alleged that Bill Clinton either raped them or had sexual affairs with them. So in that sense, kind of neutralizing the Access Hollywood stuff. And then he followed Hillary around on the stage in this weird way that was meant to be intimidating, and she didn't seem intimidated, but it was weird. And I think part of what Harris learned from that is don't give him an inch, because, you know, in a way, in the debate stage, it wasn't so relevant because they both stayed in their spots. But if you look at the footage of them at the 9/11 memorial yesterday, where they did this very awkward handshake, and Trump is trying to pull her in on the handshake. He's trying to do the two-hand handshake, and she's not having it.
Yeah, there was a bit of that in the even in the debate. Like, there was, like, a weird handshake woman.
She went up and stuck her hand out.
Yeah, exactly.
Kind of settling the question of, are they going to shake hands?
Yeah. No, which I think was the exact right approach. I mean, she was, like, clearly, I mean, to be, like, perfectly honest, she did seem a little bit, like, sort of uncertain and wavering at the start. And I think that was due to the fact that she was expecting one sort of question of, introducing yourself, and then it got they threw her off by asking about the economy. But I mean, she was, for the vast majority of the debate, she's, like, very poised, very confident, and obviously that sort of stage stuff matters a lot. But I think it also matters in terms of, like, the sort of, like, message that she's trying to present, which is that, you know, even though she's, like, running for the party that's currently holds the White House, she will represent, like, a new page in history, like, something, we're turning the page, I'm younger, and I'm different. And Trump really did seem, like, very old and tired, especially since he kept talking about Joe Biden. Like, he kept and he kept rehearsing these old kind of arguments that he had, and in terms of the her baiting him, like mentioning Charlottesville and other stuff, and he didn't have the discipline to just, like, let it go. He had to, like, refight all those old fights.
Well, the one place where I thought he had the potential to be effective, I'm not sure he was, so you'll tell me what you think, was he gave an answer that was in fact true. So that was rare in itself, which is, they were talking about, would he veto a national abortion ban? And he refused to say that he would, which was interesting because his position basically has been, we did abortion, it's back to the states, that's where it belongs, it's out of national politics, and everybody's grateful to me for that, which is, of course, not true. But then he said, she says she's going to restore it. You're asking me if I would sign a ban. Neither of those is going to happen because neither side is going to have 60 votes in the Senate. So neither bill is going to happen. And, you know, and so talking about these hypotheticals is not realistic. Now, that's probably true. But then he segued to, just like they couldn't deliver on student loans. And I thought that had clearly been pre-scripted, but it seemed, you know, almost effective.
Yeah, it could have been effective. I mean, it's good for him that it's good for Harris that he did, like, kind of sabotage himself in that way. Although I will say, like, I actually think on Roe v. Wade, my sense is, the Democratic, their honest message should be, you know, you give us a trifecta, you give us Congress and the presidency,
and we'll do it,
even if we don't have 60 votes, because we'll override the filibuster.
Well, that should be their message, but that isn't what they've said so far.
No,
she was very careful in her language. She said, if a bill comes to me, I'll sign it.
Yeah. So in some ways, because he kind of flubbed it, she wasn't forced to, like, actually answer that question. But that should be the honest Democratic answer. And actually, I do think that that's what will happen. But I think that the importance of this issue to the party is such that they will do it. And I think that they won't be held back by
filibuster?
Time, the filibuster, because of partially because of Manchin and Sinema are going to be out. So I don't know. I do think that she had a reasonable response. Although the fact that she didn't want to say that actually does speak to, like, what I think is the broader weakness of her message, which is basically that it's non-confrontational. Like the basic Democratic Party message right now is the only problem in American politics is Donald Trump. That this guy is just not normal. He's a threat and weird. He'll do terrible things, which is all true.
But like, where have we heard that message before? Where have we
that is the 2016 message. I mean, there are people who are basically saying this. People, you know, I have a lot of respect for, including John Judas, very eminent writer and biographer, and he basically said, you know, like the 2016 campaign could work if it's done in the right hand, and you could sort of see the argument. I mean, I think the basic thinking they have is that Harris is good, can run a Hillary Clinton campaign better than Hillary Clinton did.
Well, that's true, but that's not hard because Hillary Clinton ran a terrible campaign.
Yeah. So, but I mean, does that actually, like, I don't know how you can actually govern with that sort of campaign.
Well, that's the question.
And I think that you actually, like, lose a lot of edge in terms of, like, the enthusiasm of your own base. I mean, like, you, in politics, you know, it's a very dark thing, and the intellectual origins of this are a bit dubious, but there's a real friend-enemy distinction. Like, you actually have to be able to label who the enemy is, and the Democrats for a long time have thought, like, we just have to say it's Trump. Trump is the enemy. But that has actually led to kind of, like, mixed results, particularly, like, in sort of, you know, like, Biden didn't have much of a coattail in 2020. And I think it's partially because he made it just all about Trump. And if you make it all about Trump and you try to have this broad coalition that runs from, you know, like AOC on the one hand, and Dick Cheney, and not just Dick Cheney, like Gonzalez, the, you know, like Attorney General under Bush, who, like, did all sorts of horrible things. Like really, like, you know, the hardcore right of the Republican Party that can't stand Trump. You know, like, it really, like, that's a, you know, that's a problem of any really broad coalition, which is, like, it actually is hard to, like, govern that way.
But there's an old distinction in American politics between, and I think it was actually Samuel Huntington at Harvard who wrote about this, the coalition you assemble to win elections and then the coalition you govern with.
Yeah.
And, you know, he wrote about that these are different coalitions. And, you know, his rationale was, therefore, the Democrats should be feel completely free to jettison their progressive promises and betray the left because in order to govern, you have to do deals with Republicans.
The new book, Shirley Chisholm in Her Own Words, Speeches and Writings, edited by Zynga A. Fraser, gives readers a rare opportunity to engage with the Congresswoman's powerful ideas in her own voice. Many Americans are familiar with Chisholm's importance as the first Black woman in Congress and the first woman and African American to run for president with either major party. This collection of her work establishes Chisholm as an unparalleled public intellectual and Black feminist both in her time and now. Learn more about Shirley Chisholm in Her Own Words, edited by Zynga A. Fraser, at ucpress.edu.
But I did think, and, you know, maybe you'll say you didn't feel this way. I watched the debate and I thought, and, you know, we've talked about the symbolism, but let's talk a little bit about the substance. I mean, I'm fascinated by the symbolism and the stylistic differences, but when it was over, I thought that's the best closing speech by a Republican woman I've ever heard.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, like, it is, what is it? We'll fund the military, like, at the higher levels. I mean, it's partially, like, I think that their thinking is that the debate, like, the convention will be, like, their chance to actually reach the kind of swing voters and the uncertain voters, and that the more conservative middle-of-the-road voters in swing states. Yeah, and I think that there's those are voters
that
they need.
And they may be right about that.
Yeah, those are voters that they need. But if you actually look at the polling, you know, the recent New York Times poll, like, the one problem is that they're not quite at the numbers that even Joe Biden was with young people and with Latinos. And, you know, like, those were never great constituencies that he had a rapport with, but she's, like, doing worse with them. And so I actually think the Democratic Party has still, like, an enthusiasm problem with some of its demographics, and it actually needs to offer, you know, sort of meet at the table, which I think that they're going to probably try to do, like, in the last few weeks, especially campaigning out on the trail. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, there are ways in which it's a very unwieldy coalition, and it might not come apart. And in some ways, the very pursuit of those voters, like, harms you with your own base.
Well, that was my question: is how much, you know? I mean, I saw that closing, and I thought, okay, so they are targeting with laser-like focus, mm-hmm. Republican women and swing voters who've voted for Republicans in the past and who therefore don't want to be scared by, you know, the socialist dreams of a Bernie Sanders style campaign that you or I might enjoy more. And I thought, but how much does that put off other parts of their coalition? You know, like, I try to be a grown-up about this, and I try to think, okay, well, they need those people to win, because if Trump's at 45%, you can't leave Republican women on the table. So you have to make some bid for them. But how do you make that bid without alienating, you know, young college students? And let me just throw another question out to you, and then I'll want to hear what you have to say, which is, so part of it is, how much do you think they've harmed other portions of their coalition by this focus on centrist voters, swing voters? And what can they do for younger voters to energize them, including but not confined to, because I frankly don't think this is going to happen, a break with Biden administration policy on Israel and Gaza?
Well, I think some sort of break with Biden is perhaps the key to all this. Like, I do actually think, like, if one sees the big shift in the polling really came when, you know, when Biden stepped down and the party coalesced around Harris, and that seemed to indicate that there were a lot of people in the coalition that just, you know, like, were unhappy with Biden and blamed their unhappiness with the policy on Biden and were, you know, willing to take, but really wanted to support a Democrat. And were, you know, like, willing to take Harris as a new voice. And I think that what they, the Harris campaign seems to think is, we've gotten those people on board, and now we can go after the swing voters, the centrist voters. And I don't think that polling quite shows that. I think that they've gotten most of those Democratic Party voters on, but not all of them. And they actually do have to do something. And I actually think, in a broader way, I think it's like some sort of break with Biden, likely a stronger language and stronger policy break on Gaza would be obviously one thing. I think that the stuff that she's saying about abortion actually is a break with Biden. And but if she kind of just picks a fight with Biden, like, she actually said it on the debate stage, you know, I'm not Joe Biden. But she hasn't given a lot of indication of how she's not like Joe Biden. And Biden, if you look at the polling, like, he's still, you know, like, personally, people are more fond of him now because he's stepping down, right? but actually, like, he's widely regarded as a kind of, like, failed
political
president.
Death.
Yeah, and there's actually, like, specific stuff in terms of, like, economic message, in terms of, like, going after price gouging, which Biden sometimes said yes, but sometimes backed away from. And she has, like, you know, made policy statements saying that that's what she's going to do. But that was not in the debate. Like, she didn't actually talk about that on the debate stage. And I thought that was a real missed opportunity, because that's actually something that is both would be, like, a real break from Biden and earlier policy, like, really to go back to serious attempts at the government intervention against price gouging, and a broader break from the previous era of politics of the, you know, since the 1980s. And it's something that's wildly popular, like, across the board, like, popular with Democrats, but actually popular with Republicans and independents. Like, there's a, I think that there's a broad sort of common sense understanding that during COVID, a lot of businesses took advantage of that, of the shared crisis, to raise prices in ways that weren't actually warranted. So, you know, like, that's a real missed opportunity. But it's, you know, they're pursuing a very cautious campaign, And that's a campaign you run if you're assuming you're on a glide path to victory,
which I'm not
confident that they're fully on that glide path. So actually, like, a little bit more boldness, like, actually. So I think the two areas, like actually laying out like what she would do to hold Israel accountable and to restrain Netanyahu, and, you know, like really amping up the rhetoric on price gouging, perhaps like making more, you know, like some of the stuff we said about Roe v. Wade, just saying like, you know, like we're actually going to like, you know, go against the filibuster if there's some core issues, and that would include student loans. You know, I think something like that could actually help her.
Well, I wonder, you know, you were talking before about clear enemies and friends and being able to distinguish between the two. And I'm thinking, well, you know, Trump has been brilliant at identifying enemies, mm-hmm. attacking them often unfairly, but, you know, focusing on enemies and using enemies as the kind of motivator and glue for holding his coalition together. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there are limits on what he could say, and there are limits on what she could say. In other words, he couldn't say, I would veto a national abortion ban, because that would probably lose him. Mm-hmm. That might be the straw too far for an incredibly tolerant Christian right. Mm-hmm. Now, can she say that monopolists and price gougers are our enemies when she's getting money from, you know, Silicon Valley billionaires? I don't know.
Well, actually, I honestly think like a bolder campaign might be able to do it, because one of the interesting things is that once she was on board, they were getting in like a ton of money from small donors. And if she had decided to run, like, let's do this actually liberates me. I'm going to really like keep promising things that will get those small donors, like sending in a lot of money, and then go after, you know, some of the people that like normally give us money. I think that would be good. I think actually making the Supreme Court the enemy would be an interesting kind of gambit.
It would also it would give her a mandate to do something.
Exactly. So I think that if, you know, if she had said, you got rid of Roe v. Wade, but, you know, you did it with this court that seems like incredibly corrupt, and, you know, we actually need court reform, and we need to, you know, have the democratic process, like bring this court into line with, like, the acceptable standards of every other branch of government. You know, like that would have actually like mobilized people and would have like been an area where Trump couldn't go into, and where, you know, he would become then the defender of an unpopular status quo.
Yes. Yeah. Which I think is a move that she would like to be able to make.
And all the Silicon Valley money. I mean, like, actually, I mean, this is an interesting thing. Like, you know, Democrats, a lot of money from Wall Street, and now Silicon Valley has become the big thing. And there is a way in which, you know, like, as I said, with the small donors, like, maybe use that as an opportunity to say, we don't need so much money from Silicon Valley. And, like, actually, like, you know, like, mention how people like Peter Thiel and Elon Musk have embraced, you know, like incredibly unpopular race theories, incredibly unpopular gender theories, and say, like, do we want a president that's beholden to these like billionaires that believe in, you know, sexual and ethnic overclasses?
Yeah, well, I mean, the door is there. Whether she'll walk through it is another question. I mean,
yeah.
You know, I think it's still up in the air, even whether she's going to keep on Lina Khan at the Federal Trade Commission. Because she's getting a lot of, I mean, you know, Jeffrey Katzenberg isn't just a donor. He's a vice chair of her campaign. And, you know, when he says you should get rid of Lina Khan, she has to at least listen. She doesn't have to do it, but she has to listen.
Yeah, that's actually, like, again, the anti-monopoly stuff, that has, like, broad popular appeal. There's a lot of Republicans that are interested in it. And, again, I think that, you know, the Democrats have a huge money advantage. They can actually afford to, like, you know, like, piss off some of their donors and get away with it. And, like, but they're not taking advantage of it. And actually, if she had mentioned, like, Khan, just saying, like, you know, like, one thing I will say about Joe Biden is, you know, he's taken a strong anti-monopoly position, and right. That's really changed American politics. And I'm going to stick with the people that he's had that have done such great work. You know, whereas, like, if it's Donald Trump, you're going to get, like, the Friends of Wall Street are going to be running all these regulatory agencies. You know, like, I actually think, you know, that would have made a difference. And again, it's not just it's good to think of this beyond a left-right spectrum of, you know, this appeals to progressives. These are actually like very progressive policies that have a broad appeal, like across the board, and would actually, again, make you her the anti-system candidate and make Trump the defender of an unpopular status quo.
So I guess the obvious closing question is, where do we go from here?
I actually think that the real campaign is now going to go into the sort of swing states, and you're going to see a lot of campaigning, even more than we've seen before. I believe Harris is going to start opening up to like doing more media and doing more interviews. And what I would like to see, and I don't know if it's going to happen, is if, you know, some of the stuff that we said she wasn't talking about enough, which are her actual policies, especially with respect to things like price gouging, if she's like, you know, if she starts talking about that more and trying to find ways of getting at venues and taking up issues that are going to appeal to the sort of, you know, part of the Democratic base that's still unhappy.
Right. Well, I think we'll have to wait a few days still to see whether there's much of a polling bounce from this.
Oh, I'm pretty confident there will be, just because we've seen it like before. I mean, like, even though Hillary lost, like, she actually did gain ground after each of the debates. It's unfortunate it was like squandered for other reasons. And the same with Biden. So like, normally, like, if Trump does badly, he does actually like end up costing him. And this is such a close election that like any vote like counts. So I'm pretty confident that we'll see like at least a slight polling bump. But as you said, and it's not something that's even like, it'll take a week to measure that. But beyond that, I think these debates inform people's sense of a candidate that, I think famously that Gerald Ford, when he like praised the government of Poland in 1976, that didn't register initially in the polling at all. But like after like people kept on talking about it, then it seeped into their minds. It had a real impact. So I actually think the same thing is going to happen now. Like, I think some of the stuff that Trump said, it's just going to like sit in people's mind and is going to like turn them against him.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's hard for people like us to know who would still be on the fence at this point. But I think if you were on the fence at this point, it would be fairly likely that you came away with a sense of Trump as somewhat unhinged from Tuesday night.
Yeah, no, absolutely. He showed the sort of worst face of himself, which is, you know, from the point of view of the Democrats, that's exactly what they want. So in this case, it's an unironic mission accomplished.
All right, well, we're going to score this one for Kamala Harris, and we will be back in touch soon. Great to have you on See How They Run. Jeet here. Thank you.
Thanks.
DR Power Equipment is the industry leader in field and brush mowers. Their full line of machines are designed to clear acres of tough weeds, woody brush, and saplings up to 3 inches thick, hour after hour, year after year. Just one mow, and you'll agree nothing stops a DR. Visit drpower.com to learn more and shop the sale today.